welcome to Stereotopical Chemistry. I'm Colin.
I'm Jude.
I'm Anna.
And Corey's on vacation. Today we are talking about a paper that is within Anna's wheelhouse about copper and its role in biological processes. It's a paper called Dioxygen Binding, Activation, and Reduction to H2O by Copper Enzymes by Edward Solomon.
All right, so just before we get into that, this is, as Colin might have mentioned, an award paper. So it's just written by Ed Solomon, who's up at Stanford, focusing on more of his general research in his lab. And like it uses specific examples and whatnot, but it's kind of a story that he tells us. He begins with on this paper, he begins with focusing on oxygen binding and activation for electrophilic aromatic attack by coupled binuclear copper active sites in two types of enzymes. So I know that was a lot. So to break that down a little bit, the two enzymes that he talks about in the first part of this paper are hemocyanin, which is a metalloprotein that transports oxygen throughout the bodies of some invertebrates, and tyrosinase, a metalloprotein in plant and animal tissues that catalyze pigments from tyrosine, which is an amino acid for oxidation. And to take a sidestep real quick, I mentioned the word metalloproteins, simply just a protein that contains metal. And as a bioinorganic chemist or a striving bioinorganic chemist, I like to mention that biochemistry is really awesome, and we have all of these enzymes, but often it's underappreciated that they at least a third, anywhere from a third to a half of all enzymes contain a metal.
It's a lot of metals. You look at your kind of daily intake of the metals that you need, and also the percentage that we are made up of. And it is tiny, because you only need like one metal, but that metal is the active site for whatever these proteins do. So it's just a whole bunch of carbons holding this one metal in place so it can actually do all the chemistry.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Do you want to talk a little bit about what those two enzymes are?
All right, so copper's important. You need it in your body to live. A deficiency of that can cause all sorts of things. Mainly, like they might hear about, is osteoporosis. So if you don't have enough copper in your system, it can lead to bone degradation. It's important to have, along with, I think it also helps with some of the, I mean, we all know we need iron in our body for like blood, but I think copper also aids in certain hemoglobin things that are going on.
It helps uptake the iron.
Yeah, and iron and zinc and copper, you have to have those in the right balance, because if you have too much zinc, then it'll start to displace the copper, but if you have not enough copper, then the iron won't uptake. So it's all a very delicate balance between the your body. So, so the reason it's important and the reason that you actually use it is, so a couple important enzymes, just big ones that are... the first one that Anna talked about, which was the
tyrosinase. Yep.
The first one that Anna talked about, the tyrosinase, that is important, and she mentioned that it has to do with oxidizing phenol compounds, and that's important because you can see it in everyday life when your fruit turns brown. That's one of the things that happens when phenols oxidize, they turn into darker colored compounds, so you can see when apples
also,
or potatoes turn brown.
Guacamole.
Avocado. Yeah, avocado. Yeah, when your guacamole turns brown, that's from it. And it also has to do with melanin production. So when your skin is, or your skin could get damaged by UV light, it'll produce melanin, so you don't get as sun damaged, I suppose.
But
it helps reduce those radicals.
It's not bad for you, though, right?
What?
Like the oxidized form of phenol to, what's this called?
I think everything in moderation, really.
This is actually one of the things where you tend to hear a lot about antioxidants, like, oh, you want to drink, you have lots of antioxidants. Drink wine, it has antioxidants. Drink tea, it has antioxidants. But there are certain things that you need to, you know, have oxidized. So, and copper is an important player in some of those things. Probably one of the biggest ones is, cytochrome C oxidase, which is really important in bacteria and in our body's mitochondria, because it's important in the step to produce ATP, which is, you know, the powerhouse and the energy source for all of your biological processes. So it's part of that. It's an important part of the, I guess, citric acid cycle, wouldn't it be?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, so, so that's why copper is important, and that's why you need it. You don't need a ton. It's something like 3 milligrams or 4 milligrams a day.
Yeah.
It's a pretty small amount.
And as a matter of fact, if you have too much copper in your body, it's going to cause some Wilson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's,
So don't, not too much, not,
I mean, everything, you know, we always talk about, you know, this is good for you and this isn't good for you, but what's interesting, and as Colin kind of outlined there, was there are so many of these, you know, metalloenzymes or just regular enzymes and all these reactions happening in our system, whereas most of chemistry is focusing on one of those and getting a better idea of that outside the body, as well as then, like, the biochemist looking at it inside the body. But you have to remember, it gets incredibly more complicated once you enter inside the body, because they're all working together.
And competitive and cooperative manner.
So, like you said, like, the we have to have enough copper for the whole iron, zinc. Everybody has to get along.
Yeah.
But so when you have something wrong with one of them, you know, you can have a million things wrong with you. So I think the takeaway from that is metals are the coolest. Is that it? All right.
Yeah. It goes a long way.
Yeah. All right. So both of those enzymes, starting with, we're going to go back to the hemocyanin and, or hemocyanin, I don't know how you say it. I should know how you say it. Don't know how you say it. And the tyrosinase, both contain two copper atoms, and they reversibly bind a single oxygen atom, or sorry, nope, oxygen molecule. It's O2. This generates a peroxide-bound binuclear cupric oxysites. So basically, these two copper atoms will bind an oxygen.
And it's a peroxide because it's two oxygens with a single bond between them, and then they're both bonded to, in this case, copper. So hydrogen peroxide is H single bond oxygen, single bond H. Mm-hmm. So
what does Solomon want to teach us here? In certain reactions, the oxygen intermediates can be trapped, which allow us to study unique spectroscopic features that are key in understanding the different biological functions. And we talked about how, you know, we want to understand all of how these biological functions work, but we have to take a step back to look at least at first, take a step back to understand just what's happening. And he starts with going back to not the enzymes first. What he goes back to originally is just looking at the copper, one copper, and it's not quite two yet, just one copper bound to an oxygen. And it binds what we call endon, as opposed to side on. So end on means that, so as Colin mentioned, that the OO molecule there for the oxygen, end on means that it binds to the one oxygen. Side on would mean that it binds, like, it comes in and binds kind of in between, like, it binds the bond, not necessarily the oxygen. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so one of them is
not as an organic chemist, but I do see what
you see. What I'm saying?
So there's a single. So the copper binds to a single oxygen at the end of it, or it binds kind of in between the two of them, and they're all interacting together.
We call, so side on is when it comes in like here's your metal, and it comes in like this. And also, that was a pretty awesome sound effect.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Not as useful when there are people are listening.
No, sorry. Maybe one day I'll draw a picture for you guys. But end on means that just one, like, it is just one end
of the oxygen
binding to the metal. So that's what we start with. So dioxygen is a triplet because it has two electrons in the doubly degenerate pi star set of oxygen 2p orbitals. And this is best explained by a molecular orbital diagram, which predicts properties of a molecule and provides information about its electronic spectra. So a quick review of MO diagrams. The valence electron configuration of each atom in the molecule is determined, and then valence electrons will be placed on the atomic orbital for that atom. You need to ask yourself, is it homo or heteronuclear? If it's homo, the atomic orbitals are symmetric. If it's hetero, they're slightly different because the more electronegative atom is placed lower on the diagram due to lone pairs of electrons being more stable and more electronegative elements. Basically, the next thing is you just fill in the electrons. And, you know, this is when we begin to, you need to consider certain things about the molecules to understand the MO. So things like more nodes will make it more energetic. Sigma bonds are stronger than pi bonds, we have to remember. Antibonding orbitals are higher in energy than the bonding, and so on. And you can determine things like the bond order and the magnetism and whatnot here. So oxygen is a triplet because from the MO diagram, we can see that there's the, as we said, the two electrons in the doubly degenerate orbitals. All right, so Solomon goes here to explain how different bindings can be studied. He uses, to start, just EPR, which is electroparamagnetic resonance.
Yeah, I think so.
EPR. It's very similar to NMR. Have we talked about NMR before? I think we've talked about NMR before.
Yeah, to just briefly go over, if you have an electron, it can be in an up or down state, and when you apply a magnetic field, the up and down state split in energy. So if it's in line with the magnetic field, it's lower in energy, and if it's anti-parallel, it's higher in energy. And then you can, so you split these energy levels, and then because you have these two different energy states, the electron can jump from one to the other by absorbing a photon. So EPR, the difference between NMR and EPR is one uses nuclei of atoms and the other uses electrons within the entire molecule. And EPR, the frequency of the photon is held constant and the magnetic strength is varied, and it's the opposite in NMR, where the magnetic field is held constant and the radio frequency is varied. So anyway, you keep that photon frequency constant and you change the magnetic field, and then all of a sudden when the photon gets absorbed, you know, oh, that's the splitting energy, and you can tell what the diagram looks like in this the energy levels, essentially.
Yeah. So Solomon uses that in absorption spectra to compare the mononuclear, so only one copper, with the endon peroxo bonding, and then a binuclear where the endon oxygen is a bridge between the two coppers. So again, we're going to look at what I'm going to refer to as the mononuclear, is where we have just one copper center bound endon to a dioxygen. And then the binuclear is that same thing, but now on the other end of the oxygen is another endon copper binding.
So it's an O2 bridge between two coppers.
Yes. And so with the mononuclear, there is one unpaired electron in the sigma antibonding orbital in the ground state, and this generates an EPR signal. And as Colin mentioned, EPR detects paramagnetic species, and we can determine things like the multiplicity and signal symmetry from the spectra. And so there has to be an unpaired electron for an EPR signal to appear.
Right, because as soon as...
Whereas that's what we're taught.
Because, the way it works is that unpaired electron has a little magnetic field associated with it, and if you have two paired electrons, that magnetic field cancels out, so the applied magnetic field and the Zeeman splitting doesn't happen because it averages out to zero.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then the binuclear one now, this is going off exactly what you're saying, has all paired electrons and no EPR spectra because of symmetry, they end up canceling those unpaired electrons end up canceling it out. And so we call this an antiferromagnetic coupled binuclear copper II site. Just a lot of words to explain what Colin had just explained. So the last intro into this intro topic is absorption. And I mentioned the absorption spectra is used to understand these complexes. And so in the mononuclear bonding scheme, there is a charge transition at about 5 nanometers. So charge transition, I guess...
500.
Huh?
5 nanometers?
500 nanometers.
Okay, yeah,
I was
about to say,
words
whoa!
Are hard.
It's like deep X-ray,
yeah,
UV.
Yeah. So they have a charge transfer transition at about 500 nanometers with an extinction coefficient of about 5,000 per molar centimeter. And this intensity quantifies the donor interaction of the peroxide to the copper II. And so just a second about charge transfers and things like that. Charge transfer is just a transition of a ligand to the metal or to the metal to the ligand, depending on what you're looking at. These are very intense, and we often see them in the UV or You can see some in the visible spectra as well. And so charge transfers are spin allowed and Laporte allowed. And when we say these, and they also, they normally have an extinction coefficient larger than 1,000. And so we say things like spin allowed or, what's the other one I'm thinking of? Yeah, but forbidden. That's the word. Allowed forbidden. Or forbidden.
Forbidden, yeah.
Do you remember this stuff, or is this a little distant to you?
Yeah, you may want.
Yeah. So, I know this is something that every inorganic chemist is supposed to be able to pull off the top of their head. If any of us do,
pull
that's
off.
Different. Yeah. So these are selection rules. We have two. There's the spin rule and the Laporte. Orbital rule, really. So for the spin rule, we have delta S equals zero. And so allowed transitions must involve the promotion of an electron without changing, without a change in spin. And then the Laporte rule, the orbital rule, is if there is a center of symmetry, a transition within a given set of P or D orbitals are forbidden. And so That's why we, for us, charge transfer, we're looking in the UV and visible spectra. And so going back for the mononuclear, we said there's a charge transition at about 500 nanometers. And so this intensity quantifies the donor interaction of the peroxide to the copper. They then use resonance Raman to look at the OO stretch. Do you want to mention anything about resonance Raman?
Resonance Raman is basically the same thing as normal Raman, and Raman just works by you hit a molecule or something with a photon, and there is a 1 in a billion, 1 in 10 billion chance that that photon is going to inelastically scatter, meaning some of the energy from the photon is going to go into a vibrational mode, and then the photon will bounce off, so you'll have a slight decrease in the photon energy, or a shift in this Raman peak. So that's how normal Raman works. Resonance Raman is just the photon that you're coming in with is resonant with an electronic excitation, and that means that the cross-section or the likelihood of you absorbing a photon is much, much larger, so your signal has a sudden increase. It's still the same process of photon comes in, loses or gains a bit of energy, scatters off of it, except that it just happens to be that this, the photon energy is plays nicer with the with the molecule itself, so that's about it.
So what they see for this is in that binuclear structure, the copper 2 charge transfer spectrum shows the intensity twice as large as the mononuclear, and that reflects the idea that the peroxide has a donor interaction with each of the two copper 2s in the bridge structure, and the increased donor interaction removes more electron density from the peroxide pi antibonding orbital, which strengthens the OO bond. And so both the oxyhemocyanin and the oxytyrosinase have a copper 2 charge transfer transition that is four times as intense at the 8,000 inverse centimeters higher energy. Is that as intense? Of the mononuclear. So basically it's four times as intense as the mononuclear copper 2.
So hold on 1 second, let me just make sure I understand this. So when the oxygen is bound to one copper, you've got the oxygen sigma bond, which is what's actually holding the two oxygens together, and then part of the oxygen pi bond is what's bonding to the copper. It's the pi bond from the oxygen binding to the d orbital of the copper, right? Or that overlap. And then when there's one copper, you've got some overlap, but when there's two coppers, because you're going to more effectively transfer charge from the ligand to the metal, so that's why you see an increase in absorption, because that ligand metal charge transfer increases, because now you have basically twice as much that you can shove electrons into.
Yes.
And then by removing those pi electrons, it means that what's holding the oxygens together, the sigma bond, that increases in strength or like gets tighter together, so that's why you see that increase in intensity and also shift in the peak position.
Yep.
Okay, good.
Yeah. And what they see, but they see a uniquely low OO stretch in the Raman here, which we'll explain then. And so the electronic structure of these enzymes in terms of bonding interactions is pretty interesting. The pi star orbital again has a sigma bonding interaction due to the symmetry, like Colin just said, and the reason that the unique Raman stretch around 750 occurs is that the sigma bonding and antibonding interaction is quite strong because of the sidon peroxide bridge having two donor interactions with two coppers. So it's because of that sidon peroxide bridge having the two interactions with the two coppers. So pretty much what you said. The strong sigma donation takes more electron density out of the pi star orbital than the simple endon binuclear structure. The expected Raman was the expected Raman for the OO stretch was to raise to 830 inverse centimeters, but instead it lowered, which reflects a second new bonding interaction for the peroxide to the copper two. The electron density shifts from the copper into the sidon peroxide pi star orbital, and this is known as back bonding. So we often in organic chemistry refer to this back bonding interaction, so from this interaction, it's strongly antibonding, which explains the lower frequency, which wasn't originally expected.
So the 750 comes from the sidon?
So the difference here is now this is in the enzyme. Beforehand, we were talking about it just as a structure. If we had just that molecule of the copper, oxygen, and whatnot.
Oh.
Now it's involved in the actual.
Oh, so that's where the 750. Oh,
yes.
Yeah, I see that. So on page, if you're looking at 6366A of figure 2, yeah, so the oxy.
It's the hemocyanin, so HC or tyrosine.
So within the enzyme, the lower frequency means that sigma bond has even higher. So within the enzyme, you get an even more effective push of. So there's even more electrons being pushed from the oxygen to the coppers within the enzyme, mm-hmm. which makes sense because what this is doing is pulling apart an oxygen molecule. So an enzyme increases the.
Right.
Good, because so it's doing what it should.
It's
so
doing what it should.
The enzyme is making it easier to rip apart
right.
new oxygens.
All right,
so, cool. Nature checks out.
Yeah. So now, yeah, basically all of chemistry is trying to understand how nature just works. And then we try to think we can make something that's, you know, better, and we never do. Nature always wins.
To be fair, it's had more time.
I guess.
Yeah.
So Solomon showed that even though the same symmetry exists as the simple binuclear, so we still had... like that, the same ideas we were seeing. So for the binuclear, we would expect to see no EPR spectra, but in the enzymes, we did see some EPR spectra. As you can see, again, in that figure 2, there is an EPR spectra for this, even though it is the binuclear within the enzyme.
Is it? Hold on.
How would I read EPR spectrum?
So,
if there's a blip, it means there's the same.
Yeah, I see.
And
yeah.
The flat line.
Like, how do I read it? Like, what does it mean?
So there are different characteristics of like certain metals and things like that for what you would see. There's three different types of pattern is not the right word, but I know it's like isotopic is one of the three, which means it's just basically like up, down, done.
Okay.
There's one where you just get, like, up, one that's just down, and, like, the amount is, like, the amount of peaks you see is how you determine multiplicity.
Okay.
There's just, I read a lot about it. I've never done it.
What does that mean, though? Like, okay, so from the figure 1A, I see three little up, and there's a... one little bigger up, and does it...
But basically, it's saying there's an unpaired electron, it's doing some stuff. And then when it's antiferromagnetically coupled, like in B, where it's the bridged dioxygen between the two coppers...
So singlet state paired electrons.
Yeah, there's no signal. Basically, what he's looking at here is signal versus no signal.
Okay.
So...
And does it matter with this, like, chemical shift? What is it, Gauss?
Yeah. That does matter. That's
Sorry, like metal, you're using it. Is this shift up and down, or it's
yep.
always like 2,000 to 4,000?
Nope, it shifts.
Well, because the intensity of the gauss is what determines what the splitting is.
Yeah.
Okay.
So depending on where that splitting is, it depends. I mean, that's your Zeeman effect. That's telling you.
So while you're still looking that up, I'm going to explain a little bit about. So what I mentioned briefly was that. Oh, the fact that an EPR spectra, so here if you go back to figure 2A to the far right, there is an EPR spectra that was shown.
Okay.
So, and that's within the enzyme. But the regular binuclear site had no EPR spectra. So he goes on to explain why an EPR spectra was detected. And it's because of the strong antibonding that results in a large orbital splitting. So if we go back to our MO diagrams, there's that bit that now there's a big orbital splitting, which causes a larger antiferromagnetic coupling of the oxy enzyme site. So now one of the pi star orbitals from the peroxide provides what they call a super exchange pathway for the antiferromagnetic coupling, and therefore it overcomes the spin forbidden triplet oxygen 2 binding. So that's why an EPR signal was detected for the binuclear in the enzyme. And a geometric structure was also explained by this, because the coupled binuclear copper proteins show that along the reaction coordinate, which I believe is shown in figure 3A, so along the reaction coordinate, for a reversible oxygen binding, the structure bends, or I believe he mentions butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an orthogonal magnetic orbital that brings the triplet down to the ground state. And this allows an electron of the same spin to be donated from each of the pi star orbitals to the coppers, which then releases the triplet oxygen. So this exchange coupling along the reaction coordinate overcomes the spin forbiddenness of the oxygen binding and leads to two electron reduction of oxygen to form the peroxide bridge. So why do we care? The last part of one of the first sentences I said was something along the lines of activating an electrophilic aromatic attack. And so the side-on peroxide bridge of the oxyenzyme structures has a sigma star frontier molecular orbital that's activated for the two electron electrophilic attack of an aromatic ring. And so this is now in B of figure 3 that you can see this happening. And this is, I know he specifically did work with the hemocyanin, and then later goes on, well, kind of soon, I believe it's in the next paragraph, to talk about the slight difference between that and the tyrosinase. But to look at this reaction coordinate again, you know, we start with deoxy just means that the oxygen isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it oxygen's introduced, so it binds that in this, you know, bridge structure. And then it has a phenol come in that, let's see, that's what we call a phenol, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the oxygen of the phenol binds to one of the copper 2 centers, which then we go from a copper 2 plus metal to metal ion to a copper 3 plus until it then ends up getting the oxygen to go.
Question.
Yep.
So this figure 3B says it's either copper 2 or copper 3, but yeah, next stage it shows copper 2, but there's no bonding between the oxygen, two oxygens. Does that mean it goes to copper to the left, to the right, to the like that one?
Say it again. So the you're talking about the ores here where we have
but you know the bond between the two oxygens is like broken there between the copper 2 and copper 3.
Right, and that's why there's the charge differences.
Right.
Yeah.
And then stage after that, it's gonna be copper two, like back to copper two, but there's like this oxygen coordinated to this copper.
Oh, you see, looking at the dotted line, copper here.
Is it a dotted line?
Or yeah. The bottom of the diamond? You're saying that?
Yeah.
It goes from copper two with the bond to copper two without the bond, or copper three.
So you, as an organic chemist, are gonna hate all of this.
I just don't understand.
There's
this
some
part.
Step skippy part. In
There's
there.
Some like
I don't know. How
partial bonds.
Hand wavy.
Yeah.
Partial. Like
they're interacting.
One black or white.
There's no black or white in biological
bond,
chemistry.
There's bond and there's no bond, not partial bond.
It's partial bond.
I don't know, like partial bond.
There's
right.
Aromaticity is all about partial
I mean,
bond.
Yes, but
Metals
so that's
are
what
big
metal, metal,
squishy things.
Yeah,
they can
metals,
do what they want.
Metals are like
this is the reason I don't like the metal. Sorry.
The
metals
are so cool.
Oh my god.
We got a ton of electrons and they kind of don't
I
care
I
want
it to be crystal clear. Like all inorganic flow of crystals and organic flow too. I want it to be crystal clear. But
I'm sorry.
I'm not
going to make that work for you because it's not. Because, and so that's a lot of what Solomon's doing is he's looking at these intermediates.
So dumb.
These intermediates that they want to, like, which as we know, intermediates are pretty hard to isolate often. And so when they, as he says he traps them to study them to get a better idea of, you know, how strong is that bond? How close are they?
That was the dash. I really thought it was like, you know, in black and white words, in my, you know,
yeah,
print version of that thing, so like just line, not like dashed line.
Yeah,
it's
like a little dot.
And I was confused.
Yeah.
You know, lack of.
That's alright.
Technology.
So. Yeah.
Anywho.
So the difference between the oxytyrosinase and oxyhemocyanin is that the oxytyrosinase allows phenol substrate access to the So copper 2 oxygen active site. Current work with Ken Carlin and Dan Stack is being done to trap and spectroscopically define the tertiary complex of oxytyrosinase with substrate bound before its reaction. So once again, looking at the like an intermediate after the oxygen binds to the active site, but before it's released again. So I know that's a lot for just the first part of this three-part paper. And Solomon dives further into, you know, these other things. But basically, his main point here was that these oxygen intermediates can be trapped, and we can study them. And they have unique features, like an EPR spectra, where we didn't necessarily expect an EPR spectra, and stuff like that. So,
Right, an EPR, I figured. So, I was right. All it does is tells you about the structure. It's just like NMR. So if you see an EPR signal, you can correlate that with, oh, if this EPR signal, so you know we're keeping the photon frequency constant and scanning across the magnetic field. It's this signal is indicative of a copper that's bound to this or an iron that's bound to this. Same way that in an NMR spectra, this shift is indicative of a carbon or I guess there's proton NMR or carbon NMR that's bound in this sort of environment. So that's all it tells you is that depending on the split, the energy level that these electrons split at, and they can tell you, oh, it is an unpaired electron that belongs to a copper in this case that's bound to an oxygen. And you can tell about the bond strength between the two of them.
Okay, but is it different between like each metals?
Yes.
Yeah. So it'll change because it's basically the little internal magnetic fields of the electrons are being exposed to. It will change with depending on what ligand is binding to the metal and also what metals you have.
There's
in.
A chart for like what you would expect for certain metals.
Okay. So
and
in
certain,
like.
Geometries.
Okay, organic chemistry, depends on like which, if it's the proton, if it's like proton NMR,
right.
Between it's carbon binding to it, or nitrogen binding to it, or phosphate binding to it,
mm-hmm.
It's like all different, we're using different probes in a way. Is the same way EPR, or it's like, so using different probes between, like among the metals, or just Is it?
It's,
oh, okay.
Yeah. And you can also get hyperfine structure information because of the proton. So just like you can get so the magnetic field that comes from the nuclei, you can use that and still get hyperfine because not only are you getting a magnetic field splitting between whatever your applied magnetic field is, you'll get a magnetic field splitting between the coupling between the electron spin and the whatever the nuclei spin is. So you can get the same sort of information from it.
Okay, cool. So you're using different probes for each metal. Different metal. Does that mean you have, like, how many metals existing?
That whole metal section.
So you are having that many different kind of metals?
Not necessarily. Because it has to be able to have an unpaired electron.
So that means, what does it mean?
I guess it means, it depends on what it's binding to, but you need...
So things like, so copper...
Odd numbers. Whatever the oxidation state, there's odd numbers of electrons, either from the metal itself and then plus the ligands.
Yeah, and, you know, carbon itself is 12 of their,
proton.
Yeah, molecular weight, or the, what's the thing called?
Valence electrons?
Yeah, and,
it doesn't have
12. We're using carbon 13 for the case of the carbon NMRs.
Right, so that's an odd number of nuclear spins.
Exactly. So the copper can be various of those numbers, like isotope.
Well, in
so
this
we can
case,
use any sort of metals, they can have different isotopes aiming for odd numbers of.
In this case, it's not isotopes, or it doesn't have to be, because we're measuring the electrons, so it's different oxidation states, so
different
charge states.
That's the difference between EPR and NMR.
Yep.
Right, so it's, so copper plus 3 and copper plus 2 would have different electron pairings, which means, I guess it's the plus 2 that has an EPR signal, but the plus 3 wouldn't, or vice versa. But it also depends on the ligands, because the ligands donate their electrons, and it's the combination of all those pairing up. See, I guess it's more complicated, because with nuclear magnetic resonance, you're just dealing with the nucleus, and that's a thing that stays constant, but electrons in chemistry, they're the things that are always moving around and shifting partners and changing from place to place. That's why not only does the charge species or oxidation state of the metal matter, but it would also be whatever happens to be binding to it.
Got it.
The ligands, because basically the total number of electrons, I guess, just needs to be odd.
I'm not gonna go into the other two sections. If you're interested, feel free to shoot us something we can. But I'll briefly say, like, the next part is about non-coupled binuclear copper active sites in proteins or enzymes. And so the enzymes they consider here are dopamine beta monooxygenase, and I can't even say the PHM one, peptidylglycine alpha hydroxylating monooxygenase. And these are big in neurochemistry. If you didn't get that hint from the dopamine, since that's a popular word in our culture, but so. We already have talked plenty about binuclear copper active sites, but as we said, they were coupled. What does coupled versus non-coupled mean? It's just that here the coppers are 11 to 14 angstroms apart, so they're pretty far apart. It's going to be a little bit more difficult. Like, they aren't close enough to actually bind an oxygen together. They have no magnetic interaction between the two of them. So that's not to say that only one is needed. Like, in these enzymes, both copper sites are necessary. One of the copper sites binds to it's the metal involved in the oxygen activation itself, and the other copper site is what donates the second electron that's needed for the chemistry that it does. And so a lot of work went into, you know, looking at the same type of information that we've been talking about, the EPR and the absorption spectra and the Raman, as well as, like, crystallization of what they can get, to show that these guys are able to, like, it's required for both of them. It's not just a two-electron or deal with just one of the copper sites. They're necessary for each other. This section, he like focused on a bunch of other precedent and whatnot to see, like, if that, like, the first idea was that this was a 2-electron reduction to the hydroperoxide copper species. But Solomon's group found that the oxygen was not act, like, that oxygen from the 2-electron reduction ideas is not active for here. They're looking at hydrogen abstraction. The non-coupled lacks the exchange coupling that we saw previously.
The knockout was with the tertiary triple copper craziness that I didn't really get.
So basically, in this section, they get into things like Marcus theory and electron transfer between these, because this, like, it starts with a 1-electron hydrogen atom abstraction from the substrate, and then later in the reaction, a 2nd electron is transferred from the other copper site when there is a large enough driving force to overcome
the distance. Sterics.
One thing that sterics are electronics always. One interesting thing he did mention here that he doesn't have an answer for, it's still something, it's an ongoing question that I do find it interesting, is that a recent crystal structure of the D beta M, or dopamine beta monooxygenase, is that it showed 2 site conformations. So the differences between the distance between the copper is basically what it is. So the predicted about 14 angstrom copper centers, or the 14 angstroms that existed between the 2 copper centers, was there, but there's also what they called a closed, or only 5 angstroms. So it gives idea and suggests that the protein can actually tune the electron transfer activity that they do based on conformational flexibility. And that's, like, you know, we think of enzymes and proteins, they're bigger, they're able, if they have room, they can do crazy things and move in other ways. So the fact that this is a speculated thing, it's still, like, people are researching it, but it can tune for electron transfer as it needs, which is pretty cool.
Can you still consider that as, like, structural functional relationship?
Yeah.
I think so.
Do they suggest how that happens? Like,
no,
pH
he just said.
Change, or, you know.
No, he said it's just I think he said, like, quote, interesting discovery.
Yeah.
And that it's
so
still.
They've seen that there are 2 distances. End of story. Thus far.
Right, and, like, and it wasn't. I don't think it was his stuff that saw it either. And it was just like, wait, hold on. I think it's close. No, I don't remember where he said it. But it was just pretty cool because, you know, maybe it does say this. It says, while the functional relevance is not yet understood, this suggests that the protein may be able to modulate the HDA through conformational flexibility to further control the timing of electron transfer.
Huh.
So it's one of those things that a lot of people are working on it, nobody knows what's happening, but it's kind of cool to point out.
Yeah.
And
that's
so,
weird.
Yeah. So, and I mean, he just published this last month.
I believe he's a big guy in the field. So
he is a pretty big guy, and I get to host him for the next student hosted seminar.
Oh, really?
Cool.
Huh.
Next spring.
Solomon.
I'm really excited. If you can't tell. So the last part, just to sum that up, is on trinuclear copper cluster active sites. They're present in a lot of multi-copper oxidases that couple 4-1-electron oxidation of substrates to the 4-electron reduction of oxygen to water. Again, he trapped in spectroscopically defined 2-oxygen intermediates in the reduction of oxygen by the trinuclear cluster. You know, he uses the same stuff that he's been using, showing spectral differences that reflect structure differences and demonstrate a fundamental structure function relationship. We'll go with that. And it's in copper dioxygen bioinorganic chemistry. And as Colin said at the beginning of this podcast, copper is one of those very important things in biochemistry, especially in bioinorganic chemistry. A lot of those first row transition metals are there's a lot of enzymes that require them. And
especially if you're a squid. because they use copper instead of iron. That's, that's mainly what I'm going to contribute
squid?
To this vodka. Cephalopods.
Yeah.
Squid and octopi and cuttlefish, their blood is green because instead of using iron and hemoglobin, they use copper. So it's super important.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
They really are. They're so weird looking.
And blood's green. You know, there's everything about the alien. Sorry, Anna.
No, it's fine. Let's see. Here he basically shows that we've talked about the reversible binding and activation for electrophilic chemistry by sidon peroxide bridged couple binuclear copper sites of the oxyhemocyanin and tyrosinase. And then here he's talking about the irreversible cleavage of an oxygen-oxygen bond by an all-bridged trinuclear copper cluster. And he finds two different intermediates, one that he calls, it's PI, peroxide intermediate into the native intermediate. And basically he forms this pretty characteristic proton coupled electron transfer tables where, you know, you have your native structure. Basically it's arrows pointing like across the top from like A to B and then down from A to like A to C, but then both B and C end at D, but you can also go just from one to the other.
Okay.
It's some common way to talk about proton coupled electron transfer, which either people either hate or love that phrase.
Is that figure 12?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's also, I've seen it a couple times actually in here. Maybe figure 12 was the first time I saw it.
And then it's also figure 17.
Yeah.
It looks like.
Yeah. And so...
Oh, so you can either do a direct cleavage and just reduce it immediately, or you can go through these intermediates, which are the corners of the square.
Right.
Or the opposite.
Right.
Squares only have four corners. They're all corners. That's what defines a square.
There you go.
You can either skip a step or go through an intermediate.
Right. And again, this is where, you know, studying that, trapping and studying that intermediate, you can look further into, you know, how it can become the native intermediate or the peroxide intermediate. And so basically they led to a molecular mechanism where the dioxygen is reduced in two electron steps. And figure 17, I believe, is, I think I have these last one. Oh, there it is. So the red arrows in figure 17 basically, for June in black and white, the bolded arrows show like how the reaction cycle actually goes about. So we start in the top left, move to the peroxide intermediate, down to the native intermediate, and back up. And like there are other things happening if you look not at those big red lines and at everything else. I think the other thing that was important to note for them was that the native intermediate and the resting oxidized structure were not the same. They're close, but they're not the same.
Yeah.
So, that was a big thing for him there.
So many coppers.
There's four coppers there. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. So in the native, there's all four of them are bonded together with oxygens or something, and then in the resting, there's three that are all clustered together, and then one of them has gone off by itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I guess to sum all this up, Ed Solomon does a lot of copper stuff.
Yeah.
Copper enzymes are important for us, along with many other species on this planet. And we, in order to understand how they are in biological systems, it's important to take a step back, start with just the copper systems itself, like when we looked at the mononuclear versus the binuclear in the beginning, and then looking at the binuclear compared to the binuclear within an enzyme. And there's plenty of differences, and it gets more complicated as we move on, eventually to this tertiary stuff that's like, this is way complicated.
Yeah.
But, you know, with understanding this, we can, you know, try to understand things like the current question of does that conformation change from the 14 angstrom to the 5 angstrom actually mean it can tune, the enzyme can tune
that's a lot of
activity.
Distance.
Yeah.
A big distance.
It's a pretty big distance.
14 to 15, 9 angstrom. Not even the 1 nanometer, but still quite.
But
a lot.
It's still quite a bit.
On an atomic scale, it's
huge.
Huge. It's a friggin' football field away, probably.
Yeah. So, copper's cool. Bio's cool. Bioorganic chemistry is my favorite.
Okay, so we talked about this copper things based on this like paper, and as an extension of that theme, we're as an what's this? What, Meet the Element? There's a segment name. I'll talk about the copper today. So the name of the atom is copper. Their atomic number is 29. The copper is a Cu. Like, see you, you know.
See you later.
See ya. And we don't know who discovered this. No one knows. And then we don't know exact date of the discovery either. But the history of copper use is at least like 11,000 years old, and we're estimated to have begun in 9000 BC in the Middle East. So I guess that was the time. And where no place, no exact place of the discovery was like found, but I guess like Middle East 9000 BC, like 9000 years ago. And then features of copper is it's soft, it's malleable, and ductile metal with very high thermal and electrical conductivity, and it's a freshly exposed surface of pure copper has a reddish orange color. But when it comes to, so copper one is reddish, but copper two turns to be like a beautiful, like deeper blue, really deep blue, and the copper three is gets to like purplish. So if you see the their oxidation states, it changes their colors being different, which is one of my favorite things to do in the lab.
Yeah, it makes
really
it really easy to like look at
copper one versus
the
copper two.
The spectrum, whatnot, to determine.
Yeah.
Is it greenish? That's one. Is it bluish? That's two.
How convenient that is. Seriously. And we can find.
Penny colored? Yeah, that's neutral copper.
Yeah, like, you know, copper, usual copper. Where we can find them, most usage out of this daily everyday lives, and mostly wires and cables, electronic related things, because they're like super real conductivity properties. And then they have anti-biofouling, is that the right word?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, applications. So it's a biostatic means bacteria and many other forms of life will not grow on it. So we're using a lot on the sheep. Like
so
ships to protect
ships
against the barnacles and mussels and.
Oh, okay. Ships.
He heard sheep.
Ships.
I did.
Sorry.
It's like, why are we?
Bigger.
Why are we stopping sheep from growing?
Not
this new
sheep,
nano
man,
form of
but like
nano form of herding.
Sheep. You know, and also like we just said, antimicrobial applications. Not so copper alloy. It's not directly related to what we just say, but like copper alloy touch surface have natural properties that destroy a wide range of microorganisms. So it will kill more than 99% of disease causing bacteria within just 2 hours if you have like alloys.
Circling back around our first podcast about the Anglo-Saxon Mercury.
Yes, I do remember that Shalaka says like her grandma still used the copper cups.
Yeah,
to
drinks out of
day,
the copper cups, and a copper vessel, or in their case, a little bit of copper in their reaction vessel, was an important piece of making this MRSA cure antibacterial thing. So, boom, full circle.
There you go. And there is a copper-based disorders because of this role in facilitating iron uptake. You know, it's like one really related to what we said. Like copper deficiency can cause amnesia, anemia like symptoms, a bone abnormalities, and increased incidence of infections and all, a lot of like diseases. And again, if you have too much of it, it can cause like Wilson's disease. And you know, bronze, like bronze metal, it has a lot of coppers in it, like mostly coppers, and there's 12% of tins. Back in the days, we used arsenic, but we know now that arsenic is not really
let's not put
good
arsenic
with
in
our
body.
So nowadays, we're using like bronze that has like mostly coppers and some tins in it. So that's what we find. We can find them in our lives. Copper. There you go.
Woohoo! Copper.
Bronze Age, based off of mainly 88% copper age, really is what it is.
The segment that I'm going to add to our rotation, I guess, for these podcasts is chem history. So basically, we'll give quick lessons on certain people, places, or things in the history of chemistry that may have been brushed under the rug, we might have heard of once upon a time, or we never even gave a thought about. So for this week, or this podcast, I'm going to talk about Johann Kjeldelt and his method. His last name is spelled K-J-E-L-D-A-H-L. That I had to look up that it was pronounced Kjeldelt because...
There's a lot of consonant.
Yeah. He's from Denmark.
I'm going to go to Denmark.
Yeah. So I'm just going to call him Johann for the
most
part.
Did I tell you about that?
No, we'll get there. All right, so the Kjeldelt method was developed by its namesake, Johann Kjeldelt. Just Johann, our boy Johann. This technique was and still is universally accepted and used for determining the amount of nitrogen in organic compounds. Our story begins with Carlsberg, yes, the brew from Copenhagen, Denmark. J.C. Jacobsen founded Carlsberg in 1847.
The beer!
Yep. After much success with his brewery, he set up the Carlsberg Laboratory in 1875 to work on scientific problems related to brewing beer. And this lab had its own department of chemistry. So pretty much my dream job is if a brewery is like, I want a head of a department of chemistry, I'm in.
In Denmark?
Yeah, this was in Denmark.
Which?
In 1875.
Copenhagen. No, which school was it?
Oh, it wasn't at a school.
It was
just at the brewery.
It was at the brewery.
He set up his own lab. Yeah. So...
So he was, like, one of the OG food scientists, essentially.
So that's all about Jacobsen. That's not our boy Johann yet. So Jacobsen was inspired by the fermentation work of Louis Pasteur and hired Dutch chemist Johann Kjeldelt, who was born in 1849, with the task to determine the amount of protein in various grains used for brewing. So Johann had a job in the chemistry lab at Carlsberg Brewery. And so he wanted to determine the amount of protein because less protein meant more beer. And that's definitely a priority for us grad students. So Johann...
Less protein, more beer, less, more, what is it, more,
more carbohydrates, yeah. So
less,
more, the,
less protein, less
I guess, by weight or by volume, it wouldn't really matter.
Yeah,
it
really
yeah.
Probably by volume, the more sugars you can cram in there.
Amount, let's go
yeah.
by that. Like
yeah.
more...
Because the yeast eat the sugars, not the protein.
Yeah. So, he needed to measure the amount of nitrogen since it was one of the major elements found in proteins, but at the time, in the mid to late 1880s, no techniques existed, at least none that were reliable or accurate. So, Johann's method is broken down into three parts. The first is the oxidation of organic compounds by strong sulfuric acid. As the organic material is oxidized, the carbon it contains is converted to carbon dioxide, and the hydrogen is converted to water. The nitrogen from the amine groups found in the peptide bonds is converted into ammonium ions. Often a catalyst is used to help the conversion of amine nitrogen to ammonium ions. The next step, then, is where the ammonium ions are converted into ammonia gas, and that's heated and distilled. The ammonia gas is led into a trapping solution where it dissolves to be ammonium ions. The amount of ammonia then can be determined by back titration, which uses a standard solution and some gen chem math. And so in the 1880s, when Johann was developing this method, he used potassium sulfate to raise the boiling point of the acid. He also used mercury as a catalyst to speed the decomposition reaction. For his back titrations, he used a boric acid buffer solution. And in March of 1883, he presented this method to the Danish Chemical Society. And this method is still a standard today for calculating the protein content of many things, including food items, fertilizers, and fossil fuels. Yes, there have been other methods that are faster or more efficient, but none have been able to handle the same variety of sizes or conditions of the samples. And then even further, Johann has a modern piece of glassware named after him. It's a round-bottomed and long-necked flask to trap splashed material from being boiled for analysis. So Johann continued to work at the Carlsberg lab, perfecting other techniques, not just this one. However, he passed away by a brain hemorrhage while swimming in the sea in 1900. He was succeeded by S.P.L. Sorensen, who invented the pH scale. So it turns out working for the Carlsberg lab is definitely a good gig.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you come up with your method, get some glassware, invent the pH scale.
Get some stuff named after you.
Get some stuff named after you. That's pretty wild. So we have Johan Kjeldelt to thank for making our beer better. Found a way to determine how much nitrogen, they were assuming all the nitrogens from the proteins.
Were they just assuming, like, basically one? Well, like, because different amino acids will have different numbers of nitrogens on it, right? Because, like, there's always one.
Yeah, there has to be. One.
But some of them, like, what, histidine has a second nitrogen on it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So were they assuming, like, every protein has one point blank per...
I assume, yeah.
So that's why it's not the most...
There are other ones that have... And when he invented this, don't forget, there's, like, literally nothing that's accurate or precise.
Right, so he's...
For anything.
He's the first one to do anything like this.
And
so.
Still, there are methods that are more specific and better, like, for us to use now,
mm-hmm.
but none of them can be applied to almost every situation,
right,
like his is.
Sulfuric acid will break down
right.
basically anything.
Yeah.
So.
So you can further perfect it for what you need from it, but it's still a good, like, the fact that it's still used, like, 150 years later, it's pretty wild.
Does it mention, like, oh, you can get within, you know, 5% accuracy or 10%?
I'm sure you can find that. He has some papers that he's on
okay.
back in the day, but...
if I go through the micro.
I was mostly just excited about the fact that I'd never heard of this guy or this method, and... I've never heard of this guy. I guess I assumed there was a method for figuring out how much protein or nitrogen was in the proteins in the beer.
I assume
but
we counted.
Also, I'm very, very interested in the fact that...
beer
made
chemist
my beer
is a
better.
Job.
And also that if I can have a head chemistry job at a brewery, I'm pretty much
yours. I still met the scientist at yours.
I don't know
really
if I
good.
Actually want this, no. But I think it would be a freaking awesome job.
That's
if teaching good. Chemistry and being a professor doesn't work out for me, I'm going to just open my own brewery.
It's a good fallback plan.
Yeah. Thank you guys for joining this edition of Stereotopical Chemistry. We would love it if you liked us on Facebook or Twitter. Stereotopic Chem is the Twitter handle. And Stereotopical Chemistry is our Facebook.
We should also say thank you to, as someone who, you know, the moderator of the Facebook page, we have gotten people who have liked either the episode or the page itself. So thank you to all the people who have been sticking with us. We're always, tell your friends because we always want to hear from you guys.
Yeah, and if you have ideas or, silly questions or anything that you want us to talk about, they're welcome.
Yeah.
We'll probably listen.
We have various means of communication.
Yeah.
Go for it.
All right. So, till next time, I'm Anna.
I'm Colin.
I'm Jan.
Thanks.
See ya.
Bye.